Hi, I'm Josh.
And I'm Lindsay.
And this is the Hideaway Podcast, episode 29.
29.
So we finally got something in the mail this week.
We did. Our Columbia graduate degrees.
Diplomas. Yeah, Lindsay and I technically finished classes like a year and a half ago, maybe a little bit more than that. And then we took our sweet, sweet time writing our
theses,
which are 50 plus page papers that
you wrote yours on.
I wrote mine on whether or not it would make sense for more Broadway national tours to go out in tents rather than just a tour to regular theaters. And when I started writing it, I was like, oh, yeah, this is definitely going to make sense. I think about all the shows that would be great in a tent. Like, Pippin, why don't they do that in a tent and tour it? And then by the time I'd finished writing the paper and interviewing everybody, I was like, oh, it's actually a very expensive, very difficult model to make work, even more so for a theater show than it is for a circus show. But those finally got submitted and finally got processed. And now sitting behind us are two shiny diplomas.
Yeah.
What did you write yours about?
I wrote mine about, well, it's actually something that we wrote that ties into an article that you just wrote for ACE, American Circus Educators publication. But basically my thesis was about how we can create more work for new and emerging artists and producers. And my conclusion was basically that the funding that goes to supporting new writers should actually be going to producers, because there are like 2,000 plays written a year and only 200 productions a year. So theoretically, if you can increase the amount of productions done a year, you can increase then the amount of artists that get to have their work shown, be in the show, work on the show, and all of that. So that was my thesis, and I stick by it, even though some people were more upset about it. Like, you're taking funding from an already underfunded community of writers. Like, yes, but in theory, then you could give that person a job and get your work seen, which then should help you propel your career.
Just sort of what exactly you said is sort of the one of the focuses of this ACE article that we just wrote.
Yes.
Which I think people will be able to read in about a month or two from now, or just email us and I'll send it to you. But it's like 1,500 words on a little bit on how we got started producing and what can be done to encourage the next generation of circus producers and directors and entrepreneurs in America. And we sort of focus on two aspects, education and funding.
Yeah, I think education is only one part, and then funding is a very big part. That's basically 50-50, because if you're totally worried about making your money back or finding the money to do it, then you don't have the impetus to do it, even no matter how much education you have, which is something that I've been noticing with my producing friends who are younger, is they've all been working for someone else and are at the point in their career where they kind of want to do their own thing, but they're worried about taking that leap of like financial instability, basically, and where they're going to find the money to run it and produce the work that they want to do.
Well, it's also one of the things we sort of touch on in our article is where people can find money in different kinds of ideas. And, you know, fortunately for us, we were able to do Slumber through private investors, which is the way most Broadway and commercial shows work. But we're now going to be experimenting with Kickstarter, at least for our virtual reality project, and potentially for another show we have in the works.
That's a really exciting show that once we know more about, I cannot wait to talk about.
Well, I think we can tease that Keone and Mari will be heavily involved in that show.
Yeah.
But that show was sort of also looking at different crowdfunding methods of raising money and getting your show up. So be sure to check out our ACE article when it comes out. Subscribe to ACE's newsletter and their magazine, American Circus Educators. You may also know them by the name ICO, American Youth Circus Organization. They're not one and the same, but they are closely related and do a lot of things together. So be sure to check that out in the next month or two.
So a few nights ago, we saw Lorenzo Pizzoni's movie, documentary, called Circus Kid. that's about the Pickle Family Circus and his parents, Larry Pizzoni and
Peggy Snyder.
Peggy Snyder. And if you have listened to the Gypsy Snyder podcast, we did talk about the Pickle Family Circus a bit and her experience growing up in that.
Lorenzo and Gypsy are brother and sister.
Yes. So, but I had not heard Lorenzo's story or point of view from his childhood until the movie, which was really good. It was really good. But it really, really messed with me.
It messed with you?
Yeah.
Well, I had seen his one-man show called Humor Abuse, which is similar kind of themes. He talks about what it's like to grow up in the circus and grow up in the family that he did.
Do you want to just explain maybe Pickle Family Circus and just like the brief
overview? More background.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Pickle Family Circus was a company started in San Francisco, I believe in the late 70s or early 80s.
I think the 70s.
70s. And they did One Ring, predominantly outdoor shows to public. And I had never really seen as much footage as I had seen in the movie. But, I mean, hilarious, super high skill. A lot of people were involved in the early parts of their career, including Bill Irwin and Gypsy and Lorenzo and various different guests we've had on the podcast sort of involved. And you know, if you listen to the Paul Binder episode, you'll sort of hear how his experience bumps into them with the San Francisco Mime Troupe. But it was a really pillar of the circus community for a while. And I don't know, I was just left with this much deeper, richer understanding of that part of the circus culture at that time and in that part of the world. And it's clearly influenced everything from Big Apple Circus to Seven Fingers.
I think like the film is a lot about Lorenzo's relationship to his dad, Larry. And like Larry named Lorenzo after his clown character, which I thought was a really poignant way to start the movie. And I think like there's a clip of Lorenzo when he's like, what, six?
Yeah, something like that.
On a talk show with his dad. Talk show host is like, you know, ask him about growing up in the circus. And then he's like, but you can leave anytime, right? And Lorenzo goes, yes, but his little face, like, it's clearly like he's like, I can't ever leave. And that's how the movie starts. But it's a lot about his relationship to his dad. But like what I took from the movie was that Larry, you know, came to New York when he was 19, started working at a nightclub
that had circus in it.
That had circus in it. And then wanted to start a circus company, went to San Francisco, met with this like theater group called the Mime Troupe. Even though, isn't it spelled mime?
I think, yeah. I don't know why they're pronouncing it.
They were meme. But the Mime Troupe, which Peggy was in and Bill and, or no, Bill wasn't in. He auditioned, but Paul was in.
Yeah, various
Paul Binder.
People were in.
But then, you know, Larry took this group of theater kids and taught them circus. And then at 24 started the show. And then Peggy had no interest in the circus, but then fell in love with Larry and ran away to the circus. And they started the circus company, which sounds very familiar to Josh and I. And our story is very similar too. Josh worked in a nightclub with circus at like 19. And then at 24 started a company with me, who ran away to the circus because I thought, you know, you were cute and I liked circus. So, but yeah, the movie was really great. Lorenzo did a Q&A after, and I really enjoyed listening to him and watching the film. So if you can see it, you should.
Yeah, definitely check it out. I'm sure it'll get picked up by Netflix or HBO or somebody soon.
Yeah.
Visit the website, Circus Kid, Google it. It'll probably playing at a theater near you.
Our guest today is Ryan Shinji Murray. And I really like him. He's such a nice person and so talented at a lot of different things. And I didn't really know his full trajectory of his career. I knew like bits and pieces, but listening to his whole story was really awesome. And he's just like such a hard worker and game to try things, which I think are two qualities that really are like needed and
we admire in people.
Yeah. But do you want to tell a little bit about Ryan?
Sure. So Ryan's originally from Washington, D.C., and he grew up like many circus performers, first encountering gymnastics and then doing diving. He'd seen Cirque du Soleil as a kid, and he experimented with going to regular university, but he sort of talks about the challenges of both training and trying to do the acrobatic element of his life and balancing that with academic career. And after moving to New York City, he actually had his first performing moment at the one of the original House of Yes spaces. And that, you know, over time escalated to working at the Box. And then he eventually started working for Circa Waz and is now on tour with Cirque du Soleil's Curious. And aside from Ryan's multi-faceted skill set, including trick roping, acrobatics, chair stacking, hand balance, and rope, the number he's doing in Curious is what they call acrobatic net, which we've talked about a few times on this podcast because Lindsay and I are so in love with it as a discipline. But it's this massive trampoline, and he sort of talks about what it was like to create an act from scratch with Cirque du Soleil, and sort of what that Cirque du Soleil creation process is like. So for anybody who's sort of out there wondering, how do I make it as a circus performer without going through the traditional route of circus school? This is a really great story on how Ryan did it.
So enjoy our podcast with Ryan.
So Shinji's your middle name?
Shinji's my middle name.
Nice.
Oh.
Because my mom's family's Japanese.
Yeah.
Dad's family's Scottish. All-American boy.
Nice. Where did you grow up?
In Washington, D.C. Or born in Washington, D.C. Grew up in Maryland.
Did your parents work in politics? Is that why you were living in D.C.?
No. My dad's family was a Navy family, and they kind of jumped up and down the East Coast. Mom's family grew up in San Francisco. After internment, they moved to D.C., and that's where they ended up.
So did you go to like regular public school in D.C., or were you already starting to do like sports and focusing on that?
I went to Catholic school for 12 years.
Oh, my goodness.
Was it all co-ed or all boys?
The elementary school was, and then my high school was all boys.
You went to an all-boys Catholic high school? Wow, now you're in the circus. Did you enjoy being with all boys?
My whole academic career has been complacency. Has been the theme. It's like, oh, this is good enough. Yeah. Oh, this is the situation. It's fine. So it's never been like I've sought out some kind of situation in education. It's always been like, well, this is a good school. I guess I'll go there. So that's the way it went.
Are you still particularly religious now?
No, zero. Zero, absolutely not. Because this is something, like, my dad tried to apologize one time, like, I'm sorry for sending you to Catholic school. I'm like, man, like, you can't apologize because that's kind of informed who I am now.
Totally.
And I think a big thing in school is learning who you don't want to be.
Yes.
So, I mean, that's the big takeaway from that.
What kind of extracurricular activities were you doing that sort of led to your career now during that time?
So I grew up with a trampoline in the backyard.
Just like a normal trampoline?
Yeah.
That you can buy, that every normal kid has.
Mm-hmm.
Normal, like, with quotation marks.
From the 90s with the steel frame and like no pads. And so my dad was a gymnast and he wanted his kids to do gymnastics. So I think all of us tried, but I was the only one that it stuck to. So I started maybe 5 or 6 and did gymnastics until I was maybe 12. So like worked through the beginner things into the team pretty quickly and stayed there. Yeah, I guess when I was 12, there was like some overturn with the coaching staff, and like I wasn't ready to switch gyms again because it's like a big emotional thing for a kid, and I didn't want to do it again. So I just decided to stop and to like try to be a real boy and not have to be at practice every day for 5 hours a day. And
did you like the competition aspect of it, or did you hate it?
I hated it. Yeah, competition's always been something I hated. Complacency. I went to diving. I'm like, oh, this is similar, but there's less pressure. There's less like risk of horrible injury.
It's funny. You're
more smacking.
You,
yeah.
Josh, and my sister all started in gymnastics and then went to diving.
It's a common thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's less impact, and I mean,
well,
if you
get
do
some
it right,
pretty gnarly bruises. My sister, they were like, "Are you getting beaten at home?" Because she would get these and my mom was mortified, but she would get these crazy bruises. She also bruises very easily, and she wasn't very good. She doesn't listen to the podcast, so. She was pretty bad. Anywho, so you started diving.
Yeah, so diving, like, I guess 13 through 21, I continued diving kind of like on and off through high school and at NYU for a year and a half.
What kind of heights were you jumping and diving from?
1 and 3 meter.
1 and 3 meter.
Yeah, I didn't really do platform because it's hard to have access to.
So you never had a fear for heights, clearly.
Oh, I don't like heights.
You don't like heights?
You don't?
No.
Ooh. Are you serious? Oh my god.
Yeah.
Well,
so how are you comfortable going on like a 3 meter board and looking down and being like, that water is far away?
Because you just do it a lot and then you get okay with it.
Yeah.
But it's still scary. You know what I mean? yeah, I think it's important to have like, or like acknowledge normal fears, because yeah. that's what keeps you safe. You yeah. know, you're not going to approach this saying like, oh, I'm invincible. You know, you're going to think twice about what you're doing, how you're doing it. And I think that attitude has kept me safe for a lot of my career.
Yeah.
But yeah, like I'm honest to God scared of heights.
Did you see any circus shows when you were growing up?
Ooh, yes. I remember seeing Kidam when I was 12 in DC. And my mom fell in love with Cirque and started taking us to the shows every year. So I saw Kidam, Tralion, Varakai, Corteo, Kuza. Yeah,
the whole list, with my family. All the touring tented ones. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. And then I saw Obo here because my cousin was working on it.
Is he performing in it?
She was a props technician.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So she joined the company before I did. She started as a dresser on Jolion and then moved up to Varakai, I think also as a dresser, and then transitioned into props because she did technical theater at UMBC.
Ooh. Oh, wow.
So what made you go to NYU?
Complacency. I applied to this really cool school and I was like, oh, it's in a really cool city. And I think I visited the city and was like, I think this is where I want to be. I think this is the kind of energy and atmosphere that I want to be in. Mm-hmm. And I guess it's like a really high rated school. Why not? And it just didn't click. I didn't get
along.
What
did you go into study?
Not much.
Not much.
Yeah, general studies. So that's like you do 2 years of general studies and then hopefully by then they're like, oh, maybe you have a direction now. But I wasn't finding it. So after a year, I was horribly depressed. So I like didn't even make it through the first semester of my second year and just kind of like spiraled out of control and just went back home to recoup.
What do you think caused it? Just being in New York and not having a purpose in a way?
Or just being so uninterested with school and still having all those school pressures and not giving a single shit about them. And yeah, and that kind of like cognitive dissonance will do bad things to your brain.
Yeah.
Is that when I met you at the box? Is that that point in your life?
No, not yet. So this is like 2007.
Okay.
So I go back to Maryland, kind of gather myself together. I coached gymnastics for a little bit. And then just like thought maybe I'll go back into school, something casual. So I went to University of Maryland for kinesiology.
That's how you say it. Josh, he went to study kinesiology. Like it's to do with the body, right? Sports medicine.
Yeah, movement. And
how do you say it?
Kinesiology.
Kinesiology.
The study of movement.
Oh, new word.
Yay.
Has it been helpful for you now, having studied that?
No, because I didn't finish it. So when I was there, it's in the School of Public Health in University of Maryland, and they have this... Oh, I'm going to do him an injustice here. Like 60 or 70-year-old exhibition gymnastics team called Gymkhana there.
Okay.
So every day I go into the building, I was...
It's not full of 60 and 70-year-olds. It's
no,
the,
but like...
The program is 60
have,
or 70-year-olds.
They have photos from the 50s of them doing handstands on chairs.
Oh, cool.
So what the deal is they would take the gym, break it down, and put it in a like school auditorium... And then perform a big gymnastics show for all the kids and promote healthy living.
Cool.
And so that's funded by a lot of donations, and it's run by the School of Public Health. So, yeah, I'd walk by this gym every day and be like, well, I should check out what's going on in there. And it's, like, really casual. They take any skill level and will just teach you basic acrobatics. And then if you get good at that, then you can move up and learn. Chairs has been a stronghold for them for 50 years. And the coach was like, oh, you have a press handstand. You should try this. And so that's where I learned chairs. And
can you describe what that number is to somebody who hasn't seen it or isn't even in circus at all?
Okay, so chairs, it can include a number of things, but the basic premise is that you take chairs and you stack them up and do tricks on them.
But like pretty high.
Yeah, depending on your heights. I'm not a great hand balancer, and I'm not terribly interested in hand balancing or practicing it because I find it terribly boring. But that it was like the prop that I ended up with.
That's such a pain in the ass prop too, because you got to bring all those chairs with you everywhere you go.
The first time I auditioned for the box, I brought them on the subway, four of them.
You brought four chairs on the subway.
Yeah, it worked, but I was like, never again. So So they after I did that audition, they asked me to come back that night. I was like, well, you're going to pay for a cab, right? And I'm like, yeah, sure.
Yay.
So what happened then between Jimmy Kana? How long did you stay with that program?
So Maryland, I stayed for 1 year, and I finished one semester, like, dean's list and everything, but I still just didn't care about anything I was learning, because I had to do, like, biology 101. It's like, I don't have time for this.
All right. Were your parents okay with you? Yeah, I need to be flipping. Were your parents okay with you kind of not wanting to do the academic route?
I think at first. Yeah. I remember, like, because, like, dropping out of NYU and, like, the kind of state of depression I was in was probably pretty alarming for them. So I think they were happy that I went back into school, but I think they could also sense that I wasn't really cool with it there either. But mm-hmm. I was the kind of, like, going to school, knowing that at the end of the day I could go to practice and that would be the fun thing I was looking forward to. And, like, because that's always been, like, my passion is just moving and doing fun tricks. And so when did I decide to stop?
Well, right back to New York City.
Okay, this here's where the like circus roller coaster takes off. So I'm doing this thing and I'm like having a lot of fun, not having a lot of fun in school, and I go through this breakup. So it was like the first breakup where I'm like, oh, this girl is everything, and then she jumps me, and I'm like, the carpet's pulled out from under my feet, and I'm like, okay, pause. What am I doing? What am I doing that makes me happy in life? And I kind of, like, stopped and thought about it. I'm like, I'm doing this thing at school that's not involved with school, and it makes me really happy. And, like, doing a cartwheel for a kid and having them freak out is, like, it's such a magical thing that I need to do more of. So, like, after, like, recovering from this breakup, I'm like, all right, I'm gonna do circus.
How old are you at this point?
21.
Oh, wow. So that's like the real breakup. That's the first real feeling of heartbreak.
Right.
You're like, oh, this, I'm an adult, sort of.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So I withdraw from all my classes. I finished the year, though, with the gymnastics team. and I started assembling a demo reel. And I think the day that I withdrew, I had done all the editing and I made this, like, hilariously long 12-minute video of all the stupid tricks I'm doing, like all the gymnastics apparatuses, the trampolines, the chairs, teeter board, because they also had teeter board, martial arts tricking, added some kung fu because I was studying that for a couple of years in high school. And just, like, sent it off. It was, like, 5 in the morning. Like, recorded the personal video bit, sent it off, went to sleep at, like, 5 in the morning. And I get a call at 11 a.m. asking to organize a live audition, which I did months later in Orlando. But that was, like, kind of the instant.
Who'd you send it to?
To Cirque du Soleil
Casting. Okay, that's just what I figured.
Just put it right on their website.
Yep. Went to the website. And
you went to sleep and then Cirque called you the next morning.
Wow. It was absurd. I couldn't have imagined that. But it was kind of like the validation that I needed to be like, okay, this is the right track. And so I went to Orlando. No, I moved to New York. Not yet. Between then and there. Yeah, I went to audition in Orlando.
What was the Cirque audition process like?
Pretty crazy. Because I didn't have an act. And so I auditioned as like an athlete. So went to a gym in Orlando and did the apparatuses I was comfortable with. I was able to show off a lot of tricking, which probably they hadn't seen a lot of at that point. And so they do their cuts, and then you do the
acting and
dancing.
Tricking is sort of like a style of tumbling that is like gymnastics tumbling, but also not like gymnastics tumbling, right?
Yeah, so it's based in martial arts. So it takes elements of capoeira, karate, taekwondo, and just all the flippy, spinny kicks. And, mm-hmm. So it has a really unique style that I think makes me stand out. And I think it still does. So yeah, they do their whole acrobatic thing. They make cuts and they do the acting and dancing. And then if you pass through all that, then you get into their database. And then I also, as a bonus, got to try the wall at La Nuva. Because the next day they were doing act auditions there. So I got to watch a couple act auditions and then got to jump on their wall. And that was the first time I ever touched a trampoline.
I think this podcast is going to have a fair bit of explaining in it of what these things are. Explain what trampoline is for a minute. I remember seeing this number on the videotape of La Nuba, and it shattering my brain, being like, oh my God, that's where it's at. Like, that looks like the most fun ever. So maybe you could explain sort of what it is.
So trampoline came about, rumor has it, in the backstage at Mystère. They had a trampoline against the wall and people just messing around were running up against the wall. And then somebody saw that and thought, wow, that would make a cool act. So then for La Nuba, they created this thing, which is a wall that's about 10 feet above the trampoline, maybe more. And then you have a trampoline next to it. So that allows you to run up and down horizontally against the wall, or stand on top of the wall and jump off onto the trampoline and do tricks either down or up. And also there are windows, which gives you possibilities to escape through and come back out onto the trampoline.
But so I think I saw that video when I was 16 or 17, and I was just doing Smirkus that summer. And we're like, we have to figure out a way to learn this. And we had a trampoline act in the show that year. And they put the trampoline up next to like an 18-wheeler flatbed and did it on the side of that.
I think that's the first Cirque show I saw.
La Nuba in Disney?
Yeah, at Disney World.
Thanks.
So you saw that. They let you do it. They let you jump on it?
Yeah. I guess they just, me and one other guy, they were like, oh, let's see what you can do, if you can pick up on this quickly. And I don't think I impressed anybody, but that put a seed in the back of my head for later, which would come in handy.
Did you get into their database? You clearly got into their database.
Yes.
Did you get a job offer immediately, or were you? No.
No, totally green. I had no experience outside of doing these school shows. So I was like, all right, I'm going to go to New York because that's where I know a couple people. I don't know how circus works. I don't know anybody in the industry. So I'm just going to go and I'm going to figure it out. Because at this point, I was also open to the possibility of maybe going into stunts with my martial arts background. Like if you can fall and you can jump and you can kick things and you can be a stuntman. So I move up here. My parents asked about it, how they felt about it. I remember they were like, all right, you can go to New York, I guess, if that's what you want to do. But you got to give us back the credit card. Oh, I'd hand that over. So I move up here, and I got a job pretty immediately because one of my tricking friends went to high school with a guy who was the manager at TSNY.
Oh, okay.
And trapeze school was looking for a trampoline instructor because they were just understaffed at the time. So I went in. Do you ever go to that tent on 30th?
Yes.
Yeah. So I walked in there and just like, it's the first time I'd ever seen like flying trapeze really. And I met the manager and he's like, can you teach me a backflip? I'm like, sure. I went through the steps. He's like, okay, when can you start?
Can you teach me a backflip?
Sure.
No, you say that, Ryan, but you haven't seen me try anything.
So TSNY was pretty great. Pretty great to me because I got to have a trampoline to practice on, had a job that gave not a lot of income, but kind of enough to stay afloat while I figured this thing out because I didn't know what I was doing yet. So get here. Oh, and I put in an order for my own set of chairs with like every dollar that I had in the world. So it was like $2,000, I think, from CBE to get 6 chairs and a carrying case.
And so, they fall down or do they always stay?
Oh, they have to stay rigid.
Right.
Or else they're not structural.
Right.
So, yeah, put in order for that. And it was just like, oh, I hope I didn't make a terrible mistake. Because they took like 5 months to make and get
Whoa.
Here. Yeah, CBE, they're
make
very old
order.
School.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I remember asking him, like, well, what size chairs usually like standard for you? He goes, I don't know, what's a trapeze bar, an arm and two fists? Like, that's so true.
Yeah.
So I measured a couple chairs and chose my
dimensions.
My dimensions, and then had them made. But I didn't even start performing that until like a year after I'd been in New York.
How did you end up at the box?
How did I end up at the box?
Which is how we met.
Right. The journey to the box starts with House of Yes.
Oh.
Yeah.
Whoa, weird.
So the first place I ever did the Chairs Act was at House of Yes.
Which so, space were they in at the time?
2.0.
Okay.
So I had seen a couple of shows there, and the first person I moved into, I sublet from my friend who used to hang out there a lot, and so I asked my friend, like, oh, can I do one of those variety shows you do? Because I have this act that I want to try out. So I did it there, and I got a video of it, and it was great. It went so well. It was, like, the first time I'd ever done a solo act, and I did pretty much the same act you know from the box, except five chairs high, because okay, it yeah. didn't have a ceiling. And Anya one day was like, hey, I organized an audition for you at the box. You should go check it out, but don't take anything personally.
Which is great advice, advice I've ever heard for a box audition. That's amazing advice.
Oh, my God.
Nice one, Anya. Yeah.
Also, this whole story, now that we know Kay and Anya so well, I can just imagine this whole thing so clearly. And that sounds so much like Anya.
Yep.
Like, hey, I arranged this for you. Go.
Who did you audition for when you went to the box?
Simon wasn't there. It was Richard and David.
Did they like
maybe
it?
Maybe just Richard and David. Yeah, they love the act. They're like, that's so cool. How can we make fun of you? Yeah. They call up Simon. It's like, what does he look like? Well, he's kind of Asian. Are you Asian? But yeah, like it was so funny coming into that, never having been there and not knowing what they were about. And it's like, so we have this really like strange conversation, and they're like, okay, great. Can you come back at 10 for light tech? Like, what, tonight? So, yeah, I came back and watched the show for the first time before going on, like, what have I gotten myself into? But that started a pretty long relationship there. Like, between 2010 and 2013, when I started here, every time I was back from LWAS, I would kind of stop in there and perform because it was...
Yeah. Well, I remember the first time you told me that you were going to do LWAS, and I was like, dang, that's awesome. And then you disappeared for 6 months. And I was like, yeah. I was like, how was it? You're like, it's great. But you joined ID, right?
Yes. So all this happened at kind of at the same time. At the end of Circus of Circus and getting into the box, I get a call on like a Thursday because I had auditioned a few months before at LWAS. I was living with Adam Woolley and Richie McGuire. Huh. And Adam's like, oh, this great company is auditioning in Montreal. We should go. So we all auditioned. Richie got the part. So he did Chairs. And the coach, Christoph, was like, well, we'll keep in touch. And then when I went to see the show at the first small show, Complètement Cirque, I watched the show, and then Christoph recognized me. He's like, do you want to show me what you're working on? So I went to Cirque LWAS and jumped on their trample wall a bit, and he's like, oh, okay, maybe if we need you, we call you. Because I'd done one gig doing trample wall where I got a whole week in Kalamazoo, Michigan to work on it. So they called me like on a Thursday, like, hey, can you come up next week? Sure, I can move some stuff around. So I finished the run of that weekend of Circus of Circus, like got on an overnight bus, went out to Montreal, auditioned for Jeannot, the director, and Christoph, who was the head coach at the time. And they're like, great, when can you start?
Oh my God.
Like, what? Because they knew that I wasn't super experienced in trample wall, but that's what they needed for the show. So they wanted me to move up to Montreal so I would have a space to train. So I was like, give me a month. So I took a month to kind of wrap up things here, finish that show. Did like 2 or 3 weeks in my first run at the box straight, which was really cool to have like that space to workshop my act and like get it more time and be comfortable in front of an audience. And it's just such a rotating door of characters that come through, and
it's such an amazing place just to see acts and understand like the yes. variety of things that people can do on stage and how you build a character. And
mm-hmm.
it's an amazing place to go from being green to getting a little bit of experience.
Mm-hmm.
So you head up to Montreal.
So I head up to Montreal, and then I'm practicing trample wall and jumping stilts. And trample wall, they had gotten me a coach for the first day. And it was Joel Norton, and he's worked in trample wall for a long time. He does a lot of design for sets of trample wall now. But we spent the day together, and at the end of it, he's like, well, the rest is you. I'm like, what? And he's like, yeah, I can't really teach you much more. It's like you just need to get more experience on it. So I was basically by myself for 2 months in Montreal.
You seem like you're good at training by yourself, or is that just what the internet makes it look like? Are you good training alone, or do you need somebody to be pushing you?
I kind of thrive on my own, in my own little playground space. I don't respond well to coaching a lot of the time. I've had to learn to be better about that. So that was actually kind of ideal, but it still didn't prepare me at all for the show. I did get a big vocabulary of tricks when I was there, and a lot of really dumb stuff. but it didn't prepare me for the reality of going on stage and like the choreography of the show, because they just didn't have anybody there at the
time. That's like a hip-hop style show, right?
Yeah. So I do all this training, and I arrive there, and it's Olly Lemieux's last day. And my first day, I just learned the choreography like that day for the like ending choreography bit. So I'm like shaking. And so that was in France. Yeah, I did my first show. He did his last show. And then the next day was my birthday. And then we got on a bus for 9 hours and went to Belgium. And then like that's when the real integration began. And I remember Renaud Laurent was our acting coach. And he took the four new cast members for like just a little acting workshop, and I was like so uncomfortable, you know. I mean, now I know what theater exercises are, but at the time I was like, what, why do I have to, making noises and like, what is this? And he told me later that he was so frustrated with me. He was like, why can't he do this stuff? He's supposed to be like a professional artist. Where did they get this guy? And I told him at the end of that workshop, I was like, I think I understand what you're saying, but I think I need time. And he's like, oh, okay. And turned around like, oh, what's this guy's problem? And then I met him years later. Yeah, because he was helping with the creation of Curious. And he's like, you know what? Do you remember what you said to me that day? He's like, you needed time? He's like, you were right. Yeah. Like, oh, thank God.
How long were you with Awaz for?
For about 3 years.
And where did you travel with that show?
Everywhere. It was crazy. So we would do stints in the US. We did Montreal. We would go back to France like every year. So there was 1 year we did like a 5 month tour of France. I remember going to the Grand Rex in Paris 2 times and to the Chaillot 1 time. We went to Singapore. Yeah, I mean, so many places and kind of peppered out throughout Europe.
How did that transition into Curious? Was there a time between the two things, or did the one roll right into the other?
They rolled over pretty snug. So through ID, I was hired as a tramp specialist and started out pretty slowly because they didn't have any way of integrating. Because when you're in a theater, like all of your spare time is setting up or tearing down. So there was really, really few times where I could really get on the tramp and kind of work with the team. So that took a long time so that I could get into the act. And then all throughout that time, I was still training chairs. And then when Richie left the show, I took over on chairs, took over more responsibility in the tramp act. And by the end of it, I was doing a character role and a lot of acrobatics and the jump rope act. Did you see the show?
Only video.
Okay. Yeah. So by the end of it, like when we did our Japan tour, I was doing way too much. And there was a decision that was like, I love the show. I've learned so much from the show, but I think it's going to kill me. So I'm going to step away from it slowly. And I've been in touch with Marceline Goldstein, who was casting in Cirque du Soleil at the time. And so she was always seeing my updates because I was always practicing something, learning something new. And so I just... My contract had ended. I had extended it to do Dubai. And I got a call in between that from Marceline, and she was like, are you interested in doing a creation? I was like, yeah. Well, what is it? She's like, well, it's like a net trampoline water world. I was like, stop talking. I want to do it. Like, if casting has that much trouble explaining what this is going to be, I need to be there.
So when you got there, how much of the net act you're doing now, what version was it in existence when you arrived?
They had done one workshop on it.
So the equipment had already been built?
Yes. So they had made this prototype net. They had done a week of workshopping on it. They're like, okay, we have an idea. And they built a second version of it. So day one of training, one guy gets on the net, jumps around. Like, okay, you go up, I go up in the net, jump around. They're like, okay, guys, wait for a second. We're going to put more tension on the net. And the whole thing breaks.
While you're on it?
No. I got enough. But the whole back of the net, that whole ridge rope, which is like an inch and a quarter thick, snapped in half. And it's sent a tear right through the middle of the net. And like,
so how, for somebody who hasn't seen it, which I really recommend that if you're listening to this podcast, you take a moment to go on our website or on YouTube and take a look at the clip. Or go see Curious if you're still in New York, or look at this tour route. But go see a clip of this act. It's basically this giant circular, I think it's circular or square,
rectangular
net that they can not only raise and lower, but bounces you. Well, it seems like twice as high as even like an Olympic trampoline can even bounce you.
That's about fair.
Yeah.
So it's a 30 by 40 foot net taken out to tension by four motors. So the base tension is about 10,000 pounds. And then by kipping, so like double bouncing, if you know, like on a backyard trampoline, we can achieve, I think, 40 feet of height over the stage.
And you're not afraid, and you're afraid of heights.
Every time.
You just get so scared every time. It's like, oh my God, here, I'm so high.
I manage it better now.
Yeah. So you see the thing rip, are you like, oh, I don't know about doing this, or are you like, oh, that was hilarious?
Just like the hilarious irony of it being the first day and like, well, welcome to Cirque du Soleil, this is your job. So the group, they even brought us in a week early because this act was such a big question mark for them. Like, it's never been done, we don't know what this is going to look like, we should give ourselves as much time as possible.
You say a week early, but how long was the creation process in total?
9 months. So,
9 months.
So we were there in September, and it premiered in April 2014. So yeah, that first week was wasted, and we just had time to jump on the trampoline, kind of for the team to get to know each other, which was really cool too, because our team is this hodgepodge of different types of acrobats with different backgrounds. So there's two competition trampolinists, a couple gymnasts. One guy had done that giant flying act in Zaya with the cradles and the, it's impossible to explain without seeing. And I have my background in trample wall and trapeze. So they just crammed us all together. And it's really cool because everybody came from different countries and there are all these different acrobatic backgrounds as well as language backgrounds, and we all had to come together over that.
How many people are in the act?
On its best day, 8. On its weakest, 5.
Wow.
Yeah, so the sweet spot, 7.
Can you talk about what the experimentation process was like? Like learning that, like you say, the kip of double bounce, but you need to do that, and sort of how you went from going, here's a piece of equipment, let's make an act, to we have an act.
Mm-hmm. So in Cirque du Soleil creation, you have your director who has an acrobatic designer who then has to have what they call conceptors, like the idea people. This is an actual job. There's people who run around coming up with dumb ideas. And then they delegate to an acrobatic choreographer, who talks to the coach, who talks to you. So there's this whole hierarchy in place where they kind of feed the ideas down and then you have to make feedback and send its way back up. It's a really obnoxious process because I feel like the artists are at the bottom of it and you're not trusted in a certain way. Like these people's opinions are more important than yours.
Or
it
has to go through that filter.
Yeah, it has to go up and down. So that process can be a little slow. But that being said, there still are really, really brilliant people in that chain who come up with great ideas and they send them down and you're like, wow, this is going to work. This is going to be something. So we just kind of would get up there some days and have nothing good come out of it. We would get up there and like jump around, kind of do the same old and like not have any good ideas. And other days we would stumble upon something or somebody would do something and be like, wait, do that again. Change that. Make that a little bit. But that's the good thing about having so much time.
Yeah, so, 9 months, man.
How long can you train that? Like just in one sitting before you guys sort of are all like, we gotta take a break.
It depends on what we were working on, but there were there were days where we would do an hour and be toast, and some days where we'd be there for like 2 or more hours working on finer details.
Mm-hmm. So at one point, you guys get raised up by clouds,
mm-hmm.
with like hand loops on them, which doesn't mean like, you guys are fish, flying fish. And then you have clouds bringing you up.
It's all part of the rain system. You know, what's it called? Precipitation.
Oh, yeah. That's the rain cycle.
Well, when we saw it in Montreal, like, I guess 2 years ago or 3 years ago. I was like, oh, I must have remembered that wrong. They must be birds or something.
Oh, the original ones, they look like sheep. They were made of this, like, cotton, like, oh, so ugly.
Yeah, I didn't know what you were. I was like, oh, were they birds? What were they?
Yeah.
And then when I saw it again, just recently.
Yeah, way more cartoony looking.
Yes. Yeah. And I was like, oh, I guess they're fish, but they're raised up by clouds.
Don't ask too many questions.
And then you come in with, like, rain jackets and rain hats.
Yeah.
I was like, okay. But so, well, how did that come about? Was that, like, an idea from the beginning? Or was it something you guys realized, like, oh, if we get raised up, that we can, like, drop?
I think Michel's original idea was that he wanted to have this net. And the idea is that, you know, the net is a tool of fishing. So he would have fishermen on the net and he would have fish on the net. And so I think one of the original ideas was to have 3 fishermen and 3 fish. And they would kind of like come together in the fact that this net is actually really fun. They don't have to eat each other. And that slowly filtered out to just being fish. Like, Michel wrote a 30-page script for this show. 30 pages for a, you know, a Cirque du Soleil show. It seems a little excessive. So a lot of the show was made with these narrative ideas and themes that just, you know, just got chopped when it wasn't interesting anymore.
Something about it still makes sense. That's the thing. Like, there's some core root of that whole show, and even just the act as a piece, where you don't really question it. You're like, yeah, of course they're in yellow outfits, and of course underneath that there have these fish costumes. That totally works.
And I think being there for that whole evolution, it gives you, as an actor, like, fodder to work on, because you know, like, he talked about this idea, and you have this idea in your head, and then I forget that it doesn't make any sense now, because I'm still, like, remembering what that character was doing, you know, 6 months ago, and no, 3 years ago now.
Oof. So one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about that I think you're really good at, and a few people are really good at, but it's more and more important these days, is posting your tricks and being on social media. I think that's the way most people get booked for work now, is just being regularly out there where people can just see your video by chance, that's on their Facebook feed or on YouTube. Can you talk a little bit about that, and about sort of like your internet presence, whether or not it's on purpose or it's just something you've been doing, or sort of what that is like?
It's totally on purpose. I don't really have any strategy for it, but it's kind of like, there's this really great Jacques Cousteau quote, like, if anyone has the chance to lead an extraordinary life, they have no right to keep it to themselves. So that...
Ooh, I love that.
That's great.
Isn't that beautiful?
Yes.
And in one sense, it can be really like a reason for a narcissist to be a narcissist, but it can also mean like if you keep enough perspective to think like, oh, I'm doing cool stuff and I need to share this because like it's not serving anybody any good being on its own. So if I'm working on something and I'm really pleased with it, then I think I should share it with other people. So
you've also been working on Lasso and Rope, right? Among many other things.
Yeah.
Those are two I've seen on your Instagram feed that I have not yet seen, you know, in person. But one of the things that I think, I know we didn't really spend too much time on social media and we'll come back to it, but is this sort of root thing that seems pretty clear in your life of the enjoyment of practicing and the enjoyment of like learning skills being its own sort of thing, even aside from the pleasure of performing. And I'm wondering if you talk about how you keep it interesting and how sort of what techniques and things you found have worked really well for you as far as like learning new tricks and sort of how you think about that.
I think a lot about this. The best way to learn things faster is to learn more things, because the more you learn, the more different things you learn, the better you have a strategy of learning when you approach something new. so that when you get there, you know how to kind of filter out unnecessary information, focus on what's important, and then kind of step up quicker. But the other side of that is it has to be fun, because if it's not fun, then it's not worth pursuing. So you kind of have to fool yourself that into thinking that something is really worthwhile, and then find the things that make you happy in doing it. So like lasso for one, or trick roping if I want to be proper, is just incredibly difficult. And I don't know, at the time, and nobody does it. You know, there's like maybe 5 people who are really performing with it regularly. And it's just the rarity of it and the difficulty of it was like, oh, this is cool. And I want to preserve this because, you know, in the 20s, Will Rogers was like the biggest star in America. Yeah.
When people had horses, it was way more,
right?
more common.
Well, if they turn Westworld into a circus, you have your starring role.
There's an idea for a show.
Oh my God, if they turn Westworld into... no one steal that. That's our Hideaway. Hi, Westworld, J.J. Abrams. We'd like to make a circus show out of your show.
I think it's John Nolan.
Yeah. No,
it's Christopher Nolan's brother, or is it both of them?
Well, it's J.J. Abrams...
Jonathan
and
Nolan.
It's Jonathan Nolan, not Christopher Nolan.
I think they're related. I think they're brothers.
Yeah, but it's... Okay.
I've never seen the show.
Oh, my God.
Oh,
you
love it.
I know.
It's like a Wild West sci-fi show. But now we've gotten off track. So when you're sort of, like, fooling yourself, I mean, what happens when you're like, where is this going? Or, like, you must have these, like, moments of real frustration, or do you sort of just push through it?
Well, no, I don't... Again, with trick roping, it's like I don't really have a goal, like, or like set date where I'm gonna do a number. It's just like I'm just doing these tricks because I've spent a lot of time on them, and maybe one day it'll turn into a thing. And same way with juggling, same way with rope. Like, I don't have any specific idea of when or where I'm gonna perform these things. But I enjoy working on them. So, yeah. I mean, it's good to have them in the pocket. And then the more you can expand your repertoire as an artist, the more adaptable you are. Mm-hmm. So, like, I really want to do another show with a small company like Seven Fingers where you're tapped, all your little skills are tapped and exploited. Yeah.
It's like Jordan. We're like, what else can you do?
Yeah.
And can you do them within the span of 10 minutes? We made him do 2 acts in the... less than 10 minutes.
Yeah, 2 nice. 4.5 minute acts back to back.
I'm like, Annie, you can dance, right? And act. His mom was like, it's so nice seeing Joran act and dance. I'm like, okay, it's
awesome.
My favorite part too.
And Joran's dance in air quotes. Dance.
Yeah, I think that that's a real thing that, you know, when we think about hiring someone, people who have more skills, because mm-hmm. In these smaller shows, like, you don't have the budget to hire a lot of people. So the more people that you can hire that have more skills, the more desirable you are.
Yeah,
I think.
And in the new circus market, like that's the reality. Is there's more smaller contemporary companies that need people with these kind of skill sets. So, I mean, yeah, being really great at an act is great, but being pretty good at an act and really good at doing lots of things, I think, is even better and more valuable.
And people about stage time. I mean, one of the things that I've noticed just in the 2 years of you doing it is just how much further you've come in, like, the performance element of of your character.
Especially at the beginning of the show when you come out in a little, like,
whatever. With the newspaper? Yeah.
And
I've,
like,
had a lot of time to analyze,
like...
it and think about it. Yeah, and that's the luxury of having the chance to do a show 900 times.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
900 times?
950.
Wow. Oh, my gosh.
Could you maybe walk through, like, what a day on tour is like when you wake up to when you go to sleep?
Okay, so let's say Tuesday, like yesterday, for example, is the first day of the week. So I have to come in a little bit early for net rehearsal. So net rehearsal is the one, that's the one net rehearsal we'll get for the whole week usually. Because it's pretty labor intensive to set it up and to run it, because you need riggers and you need stage management to talk to automation, because all the motors are automated, all the clouds and ladder are automated. So it does take a pretty big team of people who are paid hourly. So they really try to limit that. As well, stage time is super valuable, so we can't occupy the entire stage all the time. So we get that one, and then Usually after that, we'll have maybe a couple other rehearsals depending on the needs of the show that week. We've had a couple injuries, unfortunately, this week, so we've had to cover some ground. And then show call for the show is always 1 hour before showtime. And that's usually when I put in my headphones to do a podcast and do my makeup, which I always tell people takes an hour, but it's actually me sitting down an hour before show, dicking around on my phone for 50 minutes and then going, oh shit. And then having to start my makeup and do it in a rush. So it turns out really nice.
But how do they teach you to do your makeup? Because when I watched your little fast forward video of your makeup, I was like, I love doing makeup and I don't know if I could do it that perfectly every time.
Well, 900 times.
Yeah, you're like, I got this.
So the designer draws every step on your face and takes a photo of each step. So then they give that file to a coach who will do half of your face, and you do the other half step by step, so you end up looking like this. And then you have to keep going back for sessions until they sign off on you. So some people have to go back for 5-6 sessions if they're really, really bad at it. I did it in like 3.
Yeah. Now you can work at Mac.
I guess. I can do that one look on anybody.
You all look like a curious character? Yeah. I got you. Anything else? Smoky eyes?
Deep contours on the cheeks.
And the forehead.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's crazy. So it takes you about an hour to get ready for show.
Yeah.
And then you do the show, and afterwards, do you do like a cool down?
What's really cool about this show is that it has its own warm-up built into it. So that first act, you know, I walk around the crowd, get a little warm. Then the first act is a lot of dancing and running. Mm-hmm. And then depending on the day, I'll have cues. Like I'll be inside the Invisible Circus or sometimes in the background.
Oh, you're in that thing?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
So
you're
I
in
do
that
both
little
sides.
Thingy? Whoa.
I know,
just
it's
like
literally
in the
inside
of it?
And out. Yeah, so there's two of us on like mechanic dollies and we're pulling strings and moving magnets.
Oh my, I was wondering how that happened.
Yeah,
worked.
In creation, one of the physios is like, are you claustrophobic? No, why? Oh, I don't know. They just asked me to ask you. And I ended up 5 hours a week under there, like working on the freaking puppets. But yeah, it's really cool. So yeah, when I get to back up the clown, then I'm on the outside.
You back up the clown and you back up the chair.
Yes. Right, so I'm not the main chair balancer, but I came in, I was like, oh, you know, I used to do this. They're like, great, you can be the backup. So I was I think that was the second backup train. The first one, because he occupied so much space in the show, was the comic. Mm. So remember, I had no experience in acting, but I had just become buds with David Alexandre, the original clown. And he was like, I think you'd be a good backup. I'm like, why? but yeah, he believed in me and coached me how to do the act, and I never ever ever in a million years thought I would be doing clowning for Cirque du Soleil in French, because the first time I did it was in Quebec City.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so because they wanted to get that backup done quickly, so if anything happened they would have, you know,
they'd
that big chunk of the show covered. And it was our last week in Quebec, and it was the last French speaking city, and they're like, oh well, you've been training it all this time, you better get it in now. So, yeah, I had to do that whole thing in French.
Is it just terrifying?
Not really. I speak French fairly fluently after Cirque du Soleil. There was a point, like, in our 5 months France tour where all the English speakers left except for me. They're like, oh, we feel more comfortable in French. Is that okay with you?
I'm like, okay.
Here we go. Yeah. So that was, like, a really cool full immersion, all the emails and meetings we did in French. There's always somebody next to me who, everybody's bilingual, but more comfortable in French. So I was able to lean over and be like, oh, what does that mean? I'm comfortable in French, but even still, it's like I had to speak lines on a stage for people and pronounce it right. It was a lot of pressure. But yeah, that's been a really cool journey too, like having to learn the skill of acting and being funny. Being funny is terrifying.
Right, I think it's the hardest thing to do.
It's so scary. Yeah, you're so vulnerable. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. Yeah.
Says the dude 40 feet above the trampoline.
Yeah, right? That's
just
nothing.
Funny faces.
That's
it. Oh my God.
It's absolutely nothing.
So how long do you want to stay with Curious?
Oh man, I don't know. That's such a big question. And I've already signed for 2017. So we're going to stay in the States and Canada. We're going to go Dallas, Houston, Edmonton, Winnipeg, Portland, Vancouver.
We have a huge audience in Winnipeg.
Really? So, I'm trying to figure it out. People keep telling me that Winnipeg's cool. I'm like, I'll believe it when I see it.
Is that a cool name?
It's really cool. Neil Young's
Vancouver,
from there.
I love.
Oh, there you go.
Have you been to Vancouver?
I've passed through it. I've been to the airport. I've been to Whistler.
Okay.
Yeah. So
you'll like Vancouver.
We're going to have a long time there.
So, as you know from being a listener of the podcast, we usually end with the same few questions. And you did already give one great piece of advice, but I'm going to see if there's another piece of advice that you've gotten or received or heard that you thought was either really good or really bad that has stuck with you.
There's this YouTube video of this guy. He's like 75 and he like does all these things like he's slacklining or like balancing on rollerbola or riding crazy skateboards around. And his whole philosophy is never leave the playground. And I think that's such a great thing, just to remember all the time, like to approach things with a spirit of play.
Yeah.
And so what he's doing is trying to get older people to move and to connect with your body and keep balance, because then there's going to be less falling and breaking hips in older age, because this dude is old and very, very sprightly.
And I'm rollable.
No kidding.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And yeah, and you can apply that artistically to your life. I mean, look at my shirt.
I love it.
Never grow up. Yeah. I think a spirit of play is super important to being an artist.
Was there a show, a circus show, or you would recommend that really had an impact with you in particular?
A show that really, really marked me was Circus Records Inside Out.
Great show.
I saw it, bam. Because that was probably the first time that I saw contemporary circus outside of Cirque du Soleil that really challenged my ideas of what circus performance was. And like Jay Gilligan, the drummer.
The show is awesome.
It was so cool. Other than that, really anything Compagnie d'Anneton does or Compagnie XY. You ever see that?
Yeah.
Super cool. Their guy. You should have that guy on the podcast.
Yeah, you prepped the next question. So who's their guy?
I can't remember his name, but their leader, he has such an interesting approach on the creative process, and that it's like not directed, but kind of group.
Self-generated?
Yeah. Kind of, which seems so impossible, but you watch the show and it's so beautifully and organized and... Like, how does a group of 20 people do that?
Yeah.
So that's really cool. Other people on the podcast, though. You should have Mark Mitten.
So I saw Mark the other day, and I am still just pushing Mark to do it. But I think, and I just realized this, is that Mark Mitten, for those who don't know, is... I would say maybe one of the best magicians in the world, certainly in New York City.
Yeah, he blew my mind. I finally saw him do magic because I've known him now for 3 years and he's never done magic in front of me. And I'm like, please, Mark, do something. And then we were at the Big Apple Christmas party last, rest in peace, Big Apple, last year.
Yeah.
And he finally was doing up close magic and I was part of the trick. And I was like, oh my God, Mark, you're incredible.
I realized that I've talked to him that magic has such an intense culture of secrecy,
right?
That Mark, I mean, I'm still gonna really try my best to get him on. Seems nervous about what he is and is not allowed to.
Yeah, like Mark, you have to come to the podcast.
Say
yeah,
as far
yeah,
as
yeah.
like even just learning how you learn things. I was like, wow, yeah, the magic community is very don't do podcasts. It seems,
right.
But you know, with enough jostling, I think we'll get him on.
And because he really cares about circus.
Yes.
And so I think if anything, you can get him to relate what he does to the circus world and like maybe what the parallels are there without
yes.
betraying too much of the magic world.
Mark, tell me all your tricks.
It's like, so how do you do that?
Let's break it down.
Well, Ryan, thank you so much for coming.
Wait, I have one more question.
How long
have you been growing your hair?
Oh man.
I'm jealous of it.
It was like 2012 and so my history of haircuts with Circa was I first got there and I got this like Euro mullet. It was like kind of like spiky on the top and like kind of like pointy along in the back. It was disgusting.
They made you do that or you did that on your own?
No, I like went to a hairdresser and they were like,
no.
they gave her some parameters and she did like took license with it. And I was like, this is awful. I kind of would like, I have really bad anxiety about cutting my hair. So like I would let it grow and then like really be scared about getting it cut. So at one point it was getting pretty long and the director was like, it looks pretty good, keep it. So I kept it. And then I got to Curios and our head of wardrobe was like, I love your hair. I never cut it. So.
You're like, great. Yeah, how long is it now?
No, yes. I've like trimmed it a couple times.
Yeah.
But goes down to where, like.
It's, I don't know.
I feel like it bottoms out.
Can all the listeners hear him shaking out his hair?
Oh my God. It is a beautiful mane of hair.
It is beautiful.
Oh, dang. Stop it. I literally am trying to get my hair past my boobs and it never gets there. And now Ryan just took his hair down and it's like the mermaid hair.
Yes, you belong on a rock in the ocean.
Yeah, instead of a fish, you could be
part
a mermaid.
Of your world.
Well, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks so much, Ryan.
It's really cool that this exists because, you know, like when I was starting out, a resource like this would have been so huge. So, like, that you're making it really makes me happy.
Yeah.
Oh, well, thanks so much for doing it.
I know.
We really appreciate
it. It's fun for us.
That was our interview with Ryan Shinji Murray.
We're going to be in Israel for the next week visiting Josh's family over Thanksgiving. So unfortunately we will not have a podcast next week, but if you've missed any podcasts,
yeah, just go through our backlog.
Now is your chance. So hopefully you guys have a great holiday and
happy Thanksgiving.
See you or talk to you next in 2 weeks. Bye.
Bye.